I'm Kieran.
And I'm Eve. This is Kitchen Table Cult.
We're two quiverful escapees talk about our experiences in the cultish underbelly of the religious right. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Kieran.
How are you?
Covered in concrete dust because I've been setting signs in the garden for propaganda about how everybody needs to kill their English ivy. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not covered in concrete dust because I didn't garden, but all the trees outside of my apartment are blooming, so my sinuses are very aware.
You're covered in a different kind of dust, huh?
I'm covered in a different kind of dust, but it's warm enough that I was able to have coffee on the balcony, so it's like balcony coffee season, which is the best ever.
How romantic.
So, yeah, it is. It's very romantic. But I'm super excited because we have a podcast takeover slash guest on the show today, and I'm hype. Eddie, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Eddie. I use he, him pronouns. I've been a huge fan of the show for a long time, and I'm really stoked to be here. I am a public librarian in the Northwest Chicago area. I'm also an ex-homeschooled fundamentalist cult escapee, and I've recently been called a local pie baker by Thrillist magazine, which is my proudest achievement. So thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to have you. I've been, you've been in the podcast realm for a long time, and we've chatted off on Twitter here and there. And as librarian stuff pops up, I'm always just so impressed with what you have to say. And so we wanted to do a little mini series about the state of libraries. And of course, the first thing we thought of was we got to have Eddie on. And boy, did you deliver.
I steal all my best takes, so I'll plug those people too.
Amazing. So yeah, we're kind of spending April diving into like libraries and their overlap with the homeschooling community and how they're such a huge resource for like everybody, obviously, but also like specifically homeschooled kids. But like when we were chatting sort of leading up to this, you went into like the whole history of libraries. So do you want to like take us through how libraries came to be so we can then continue to talk about the importance and future and your history and story with libraries?
Yeah, absolutely. So I love this, that there's this kind of duality of libraries. And when we were talking about it, Eve talked a little bit about their experience in libraries outside of the US and what access looks like versus non-access, to put it bluntly. It's fundamentally very different in different areas, even within the United States. But I do like to separate libraries between two very distinct metaphors, where you have your gatekeepers and you have the people that open the gates. American public libraries diverted paths from other institutions and its own history at some point. And I think it's a beautiful and remarkable journey. And I will talk about it to anybody who will listen. So I like to say, you have your gatekeepers, right? Your traditional library science people, your Benjamin Franklin and Melville Dewey. And for your listeners, I won't spit on the floor next to me when I say Melville Dewey's name.
I mean, I understand the sentiment, though.
I always joke that, there's at my funeral, there's going to be some people saying that I'm in a better place, but that better place is somewhere in hell fighting Melville Dewey. those are the gatekeepers. Those are the people who organize libraries as a meritocracy, as a place for the elite to protect books and elevate books by their inclusion in libraries, and only offer access to landed white men. And then you have your openers of gates, some of who were contemporaries of Dewey, like Tessa Kelso and Adelaide Haas, and collected things outside of the realm of what privileged white men were saying were important. So, in even up until the 20th century in the United States, libraries weren't collecting things like fiction. So like Dickens is going to rot your brain. We want you to read about nonfiction. Carnegie wants you to read about how to be a better employee.
You couldn't have imagination. That would be terrible.
Right?
How awful.
And then you have, Pura Belpre, the first woman of color who worked for Harlem Public Library, who introduced the concept of story time and storytelling to libraries, and something that has not ever left libraries. This concept of literacy starts with, you know, one person disseminating information to another in a more accessible and a joyful way. I think that's just beautiful. But one of my favorite people to talk about, and something that I tell all my baby librarian friends when they just get started, is Ranganathan. So S.R. Ranganathan, considered the father of modern library science. He's the one who invented these five laws of library science that we still come to in everyday life, and I think has a lot of meaning to homeschoolers, victims of educational neglect, people facing censorship and marginalization. And those rules are: books are for use, meaning their books are for the information that they contain, and they aren't inherently valuable or useful. They're not to be protected, they're to be used. So that goes all the way from, you know, not getting upset when a toddler rips a book up because that was the process that they went through when they were engaging with it, and we don't get mad, we replace that book and we continue their access to the library, all the way up to, you know, everybody should have information access, everybody should have use of access, and everybody should have autonomy in access. The second rule being, and I love this one, every reader their book. So we have to have representative library collections. We have to have diverse collections. Everybody needs to see themselves either reflected in the library or see things that are otherwise going to be kept from them in the library. This mirrors windows concept that we talk about so much. Mm-hmm. And then the inverse of that is rule three. Every book has its readers. So we don't base access based on intention. We don't base access based on quality. We base access based on a demonstrated need, no matter how small, for that book, for that material. And then rule number four, which I think is powerful, and I've done a lot of talking about this, is save the time of the reader. And that is such a slap in the face to Melville Dewey. It's, you know, because his system is garbage and doesn't save the time of the reader, but B, also it's fundamental to what we do in that we don't protect books. We don't create barriers. We remove barriers to access. So we don't say that you have to have some form of financial subscription. We don't say that you have to fit a specific demographic. We say, what are your barriers to accessing information and materials? And we do our best to bridge those gaps for you. And then the fifth rule just being that the library is a growing organism. We adapt to the growing needs of the people that we serve, and which is why there's always an asterisk when I say books. When I say books, I mean any form of disseminatable information, as interchangeable with
audiobooks count.
Exactly. Audiobooks count, video games count, storytelling counts. Any form of information is information and books, and you should have access to them. And so, you know, Ranganathan in his time, it was the 1920s in India, it was in Madras, and, you know, there's British colonial rule, and literacy rates are horrifically low, and he prioritized access to members of the lower caste system. He prioritized access to women to his institution. He was one of the first bookmobile librarians. He put books out on, you know, mobile services and got books into the hands of people with these rules. And it really revolutionized literacy rates in his area. And then it provided this basis that we have good, functional, meaningful libraries in the United States. I think he's pretty dope.
That's so cool. I did not know, like...
Yeah, I'd never heard of him before.
Yeah, I never looked into, like, how libraries sort of came to be. My, like, understanding of how the library system works was, like, going to my own local library and then watching, like, Reading Rainbow. And I was just like, libraries are this cool, magical place. Thanks, PBS. but, like, the philosophy behind it hadn't really occurred to me, but it's also something that, like, I just assumed that's how it always worked, because that's what libraries always have been to me. They've always upheld, like, those five bastions. So seeing what's happening now is very upsetting.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, in some ways we failed. And that's something I like to remind myself of and my colleagues when we, like, feel like, oh, you know, we're just automatically good. It's like, oh, no, there were quite a few libraries when faced with segregation closed their doors instead of opening them, you know. And libraries have not always upheld, you know, the rights and dignity of our unhoused population. But in my own life, at least, And that's something that I want to, you know, work to extend to other people. They were that access where there otherwise was none, both as a homeschooler, as a teenage unhoused person. And in a lot of ways, they were that third place where I could have context to the world that was being held away from me at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for folks who don't know what a third place is, it's a common space that's not something that you have to pay to have access to. So like a store where you have to shop, and it's not your home. It's a place where you can exist and meet people, and it's free. So like the dog park would be a third place, and the library is a third place.
Yeah. And I think your podcast has done a great job of like talking about the cost of the loss of third places in the past, and how, you know, whether it's the decimation of third places under the Reagan administration, community mm-hmm. centers and such, or just like the third places taking themselves out by fostering abuse, like religious organizations and yeah. fraternal organizations and rural, like we don't have them out, at least not in the public psyche outside of the public library. And I think that's worth defending.
So you want to,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you want to tell your story a little bit and how you came to libraries and what they mean for you specifically?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my parents joined an independent fundamental Baptist church cult, when I was in second grade. So unlike a lot of people, I was not born into this. I came into it at a very young age, very impressionable age. It was after, you know, a couple decades of mental health and substance abuse issues in my family came to a climax, and the church was the refuge for that. The next addiction, I like to say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My older sibling and I were pulled out of public school. I was in second grade, and my sibling was in fourth grade, respectively. And censorship was pretty immediately escalated in our house, like no TV, no books. And we're going to introduce you to Bob Jones University Press and Sunlight Curriculum and all of these things that are all of a sudden very restrictive and didn't look like what I had, like, you know, didn't look like Reading Rainbow. I previously had Reading Rainbow and then I didn't. Mm. And this stuff looks bad.
Yeah.
And I don't, did either of you have Sky Angel
at yes. any
point?
Oh,
no.
Yes. Oh that? My God. Yes, I did.
So Sky Angel taught me so much about like diminished access, mm-hmm. Because Sky Angel was a Christian based dish network source where it like beamed in, you know, Pat Robertson programming and a couple different things.
Oh yeah. We never had like satellite TV or anything, like no cable, no nothing.
It was weird. Like, Kieran, do you remember some of the stuff that was on? Like, there was like a Christian music video channel that was just Christian music videos
24/7. It was trying to be MTV, oh but it was CCM. God.
It was bad.
It was so bad. And then like the kids' TV shows, like Critter Getters and Bible Man and Davy and Goliath. Oh, yeah. I when hated you were lucky. Those so much.
Yeah,
so you mean you guys weren't just like buying VHSs from the CBD catalog like the rest of us?
Holy oh, I mean, shit. We still did that too.
Yeah, yeah.
We just had options.
But oh I think God. One of the things that I tell people that I don't think people realize is that censorship, like it escalates exponentially. So like even when you are so limited, when all you have is Focus on the Family, the CBD catalog, Sunlight Curriculum, and the Sky Angel dish, even if you start to enjoy those things too much, they get taken away from you because yep. then that's mm-hmm. idolatry. And, mm-hmm. you know, when people, you know, try to, and like, I understand the impulse where you as a librarian try to empathize with, you know, the people who are attacking your library because they're being loud and we're trying to provide good customer service and we're trying to be empathetic so that we can understand them. But it's just like, you don't understand that the idea isn't that they dislike this material. The idea isn't that they are worried about their children. The idea is that they don't have control.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's what they're trying to take from you. And I was in second grade. I did about 2 years where we really, you know, my parents were new to this. They didn't have a lot of, you know, my dad had the internet, and that was restricted from us. But he, you know, they were getting most of their information from them. We didn't have a homeschool group. We didn't see people outside of us. It was very intense isolation. Mm. But I, at about fourth grade, I started walking to the public library. And that was autonomy that I enjoyed. That was not, you know, offered to my sibling who was assigned female at birth. And I recognize that privilege and I'm grateful for that. But it took me a couple years in therapy to like not feel bad that I was offered that option of escape, that avenue of escape that other people didn't. So I think that was the start of it. And then I started to work.
Yeah, there were a number of years of rage about that. Yeah. I had to work through.
Yeah. I really appreciated some of your recent book club guests and how they talked about getting social and emotional learning from books. That's something that, you know, is the crossover between being a homeschooler and being an educator, is you realize the importance of social emotional learning and how some people only get it through books. They don't get it through interactions at home. And, you know, I was at home, I had, you know, Vision Forum materials and we were watching Jerry Falwell tapes and Dr. S.M. Davis. And it was just this horrible, toxic, like barrage of stuff that we didn't have the vocabulary to really understand or deal with. But then I was able to go to the library and read Terry Pratchett and Madeleine L'Engle and Ursula Le Guin. And, you know, so that was really an antidote of towards the parts of myself that were in danger. And mm-hmm. also, you know, empathy towards other people. You know, I think there's the cognitive dissonance between, you know, interacting with Meg Murray from Wrinkle in Time or Granny Weatherwax and then coming home and being told that you have to subjugate women is a little too much. So,
yeah.
It's a powerful thing to have fiction and to have books and to have mirrors and windows. If you're a homeschooler or a victim of educational neglect, to have, you know, parts of yourself reflected that you're being told, you know, kindness and softness are bad and you need to be competitive and you need to be domineering and you need to be powerful. But, you know, none of these books are saying that. None of these people that I'm identifying with are being like that. And also I feel love and kindness towards these people that I'm reading about. I also had a kick-ass grandma. I don't want to I don't want to discount that and say that fiction was it, but you know, it was really important for me to have access to those books and policies that came up through the history of librarianship for open access, for the dignity of all people, for every reader their book, every book their reader, things like open shelf policies meant that I could read books and watch movies at the library without checking them out or taking them home. Mm-hmm. Privacy policies meant that I could eventually check out materials, and there were certain steps that my parents would have had to take to review that, that they just weren't willing or weren't able to figure out. And, you know, it was a great third place for me. It wasn't my church. It wasn't my home. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel judged by the librarians. And it was important. I started running away from home when I was about 16, 17, unfortunately, because I didn't just have a basis for rebuilding myself yet. I would eventually come back. And that was kind of like an on and off thing until I was maybe like 19. But I could spend the days at my library and they had resources for me to eat and at least sleep and get some basic hygiene, some education. And I didn't have to disclose my situation to staff, which I was really afraid of doing. Mm-hmm. I was sleeping in my car or at the Salvation Army on and off, but I knew that I could depend on, you know, anyone. I live in a pretty populated area, so I had four or five libraries at any given time that I could spend at. And no matter how bad things could get for me, the library was the floor. So, mm-hmm. you know, they raised that situation for me. And again, that's something that I recognize that because of how I present and how I look and everything, it was different for me than it is for other people. But I saw what it could be, at least.
Yeah. I feel like that's so important and not something that people usually think about when they think about libraries is the sort of like direct services that they provide, which is something that I find just incredibly powerful. It's one of the few spaces that like is okay socially accepted in the US to be like a direct services provider that does not have like a profit model at its center. Like it is socialism and it is okay and it is fine and no one is worse off for it. And that's the only thing in which like that's, you know, politically okay is for the libraries to be that center. And it is so crucially important for everybody to have access to those resources.
And in a lot of ways, the things that we do are things that the Christian right claims to have a corner on the market of, where we're we're providing lifelong learning, like we're helping your kids learn community and you know, get to know other people and you know, graduate from one step to the next, and you know, we're providing, you know, we're we, a lot of times we are the only person who's talking to your Mima who's either not being paid or trying to be paid.
And
you know, we have this, like, considering the fact that, like, we are a socialist institution, we are very, you know, in tune with the needs of your family. And that's something that people need to learn. That's how it works. We take care and we care. And yeah, because of that save the time of the reader philosophy, we are considering things that are standing in the way of people and literacy in all of its forms, including health literacy, including, you know, food literacy and community literacy, and making sure that people have access to, you know, all of the lower levels of need that arise in their lives that, you know, keeps them away from being able to sit down and actually read a book.
Yeah.
One of the things you were talking to us about last time we talked was about how, you know, my understanding of like libraries is like they'll prioritize books that get checked out, and you are fighting for keeping like certain basic things to be in the library, even if they're not being checked out for access, like you're describing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have principles that we follow for how to run a library equitably and ethically, and making sure that we're, you know, it would be really easy, especially as somebody who purchases for a collection and markets for the collection and weeds the collection, meaning I buy the books, I write reading lists, I put together displays, and then eventually, because we do not have unlimited space and books get written all the time, we have to get rid of books. Mm-hmm. So it'd be really easy for one person to skew a collection towards their interests or their ideals. And it happens, you know, there's also self-censorship, which, you know, skews library collections towards the ideals of whoever is scariest to the person who's selecting. But, you know, one of the things that we have to do to really care for our community is do the collection outside of the interactions that we're already getting. So, you know, one of the stimulus for working on a collection is demand, right? So how, what books people are asking for, what books people are checking out. And that demand is historically going to be people who are already using your library.
Right.
People who are not only already using your library, but are the ones who are most comfortable asking for things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's, you know, just, that's just, sometimes that's just societal privilege, but then sometimes it's also an orchestrated bad faith campaign to request books that they're not going to read, but they want in your library as a statement. Mm-hmm. But doing the work of, you know, making sure that every person is reflected, either, you know, seeing themselves or having an experience that they're otherwise, you know, being prevented from having through information literacy, is looking at who you're serving, who is not currently interacting with you, and basing your circulation on that, understanding your demographics, understanding situations like homeschoolers who are not currently coming into your library or who don't have access because of parental limitations, and finding a way to reach them, finding a way to at least represent them when they're ready to come to us. And then another way is making sure that we're looking at for invisible things like people coming to the library and checking out books or not checking out books because they're reading them in the library and they don't want to take them home because they're unsafe to read them at home or they're unsafe to put their name to.
Right.
So I was, you know, coming in and reading books about, I was reading Carl Sagan because, you know, why do my parents hate this man so much? I don't even know who he is.
Right.
You know, they're using his name as a you know, a buzzword, as a dog whistle. So, you know, but if I checked out a Carl Sagan book and brought it home, or my parents saw the book or saw it on my record, then I'm going to get hit more.
Right.
And if I read it at the library, but I don't check it out and nobody's paying attention to that sort of thing, nobody's paying attention to books about divorce, about domestic abuse, about sexuality that are either being left on tables or just don't seem to be circulating as much. Just understanding the needs of the community go beyond how people are traditionally interacting with us. Mm-hmm. So making sure that we're, you know, bumping up the statistics a little bit on books that we know people are a little bit more hesitant to check out, but making sure that they're still available through those open shelf policies. So somebody can come into the library, not have a library card, not be from our area, and still check that book out, or still, you know, read that book, not check it out. Sorry. And we consider that valuable, whether or not it's part of our statistics, and we value that book outside of traditional circulation statistics. Mm-hmm.
You also have in our the notes about what we were going to talk about for this episode, you mentioned like there's kind of like insidious methods of censorship that may not be things that are easily recognizable, and then also just like more nuanced ways of increasing access to information.
I'd love to hear more about those. This is one of those things where, you know, they're kind of throwing everything at us right now. They're going to try to get us to ban books, and if they can't get us to ban books, then they're going to try to put us in prison for providing banned books.
Right.
But I sometimes think that the more insidious things are the small easy things to get away with. So, you know, there's little technicalities that, you know, despite the fact that we are not a for-profit institution, nor should we ever be a for-profit institution. It's a societal good to have libraries, to have information access and a place for people to go. We still get hangups on like the capitalism structure of interacting with our patrons. So making sure that, you know, everybody has a library card with multiple forms of identification, putting them within the tax bracket of the district is a way that some people kind of prevent like how we should care about the people who we're interacting with. So, you know, the examples that I just talked about are examples of people who are not demonstrating that they are from our district, that their taxes are serving our library, and therefore we're serving their needs as public representatives. People can get stuck up on that, and then they can get stuck up on fines or fees, making sure that we record all this information about people so that, you know, we can hold them financially responsible. And then that backdoor leads to, you know, anybody under 18 should have, you know, we should be tattling on everything that they're reading, because otherwise, how are we going to make that money back from that book if we don't get it back? And it's like, that's
the idea of making that money back from that book. Oh my goodness.
Books are for use.
There's so many intangibles there. Like you can't put a value on it like that.
Exactly. No. So the motivation behind that is parental control or, you know, some sadistic form of library control over the relationship between the providers of information and the receivers. Reciprocal borrowing is a really great thing, but yeah, sometimes, you know, especially areas that have more access and more wealth will put limitations on reciprocal borrowing. So if you live outside of district, you can have X, Y, and Z, but not A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they will, you know, so libraries will, they'll genreify and they'll put things in different sections. So a lot of ways that people get around ban books without banning books is that they'll either move something from the children's section to the adult section, and therefore make it harder for serendipitous discovery or easier for parents to say, no, that's an adult book, you know, even if it's, you know, a kid's picture book. But if somebody has an issue with some of the contents, then all of a sudden it's an adult book.
Right.
And then some libraries will prevent access for children's cards to check out adult books then. So thankfully the library I grew up in did not have that. You know, any book is up to the reader to decide whether or not they are capable of handling it. And seriously, in most cases, I'm sure you've had conversations with guests about this. If your child is living in a safe environment, they're pretty resilient of what they can see in public and read and, you know to talk to their people about what is safe and what is not safe.
Yeah.
But that's not something that homeschoolers have.
Yeah. If you're in situations like we were, like you end up hiding things, like I would have my little book bag with my French textbooks, and I would like, you know, sandwich whatever books I got from the library in between them. So if you looked, you would just like see my French textbook in my notebook, and like it would be harder to notice like that I had you know, checked out three other books.
Yeah.
Sneak in home the boxcar children.
Oh no, sneaking home the romance novels. But you know, you do you.
Yeah, yeah. I was a big fan of stealing dust jackets from my parents' books and putting them over books.
That that's a good trick.
Tried and true. Yeah, that's a good one.
It's always solid. So
I didn't actually read like that biography of Ronald Reagan four times. It just fit.
I'm so disappointed in you.
And librarians, teen librarians will teach kids how to do like make book cover crafts. And it's always cheeky. It's just like decorate your books. And it's just like, no, we know what you're doing.
Like this is good, useful information, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. You're bringing home Flamer and you don't want your dad to
no. Yeah.
Yeah. Lexiles recataloging. Those are always issues. So like, you know, libraries will put reading levels, on things based on, you know, the scientific lexiles, which most librarians worth their salt will ignore and recommend parents ignore based on their child and what their child needs. But also that's a good way for people to just basically be like, oh no, this subject matter is for an older group. Let's, you know, categorize these as such.
That kind of stuff is so artificial. Like it doesn't make sense to me. Like, obviously I'm not a parent and I'm sure parents would have so many opinions about like the nuances of what's actually appropriate or not. And by that, I mean like well-intentioned parents who like have their children's, you know, interest in their children's open-mindedness at heart. But like, I really like, I devoured everything. Like, I literally had this point where I was, like, 14 and I'd read every book in the house and included my mother's medical textbooks because she was a nurse. And that included the, like, Greek New Testament parallel translation into English, like, textbook. Like, it's just, like, mm-hmm. I'd read it all. Like, what is it is and is not appropriate is such an artificial thing.
My absolute favorite library experience was when I was 11 and my mom had read us like the Moby Dick picture book like that winter before because we were visiting New Bedford, so we saw all of like where Herman Melville wrote the book. We went into the church, we saw the like giant boat thing, and I really loved the story in the picture book form, so I of course wanted the full complete unabridged version. So I went to my library and they found it for me and they wished me luck reading it, and it was like there was no like, are you sure this isn't gonna be too, it was just like, dude, go for it, you tried it, like, you know. And it was the most like, I couldn't finish it because like the first like, my name is like, call me Ishmael was like 18 million letters long, but like it was such an empowering feeling to know that I could go to the library and be taken seriously by a librarian as like an 11-year-old wanting to try reading like a book from the 1800s in its full glory. And yeah, they're just like, yeah, okay.
That reminds me, I have a story like that too, but it doesn't involve the library, but it does make my father look bad, so I'll tell it. So I was 9 and my babysitter was reading The Hobbit for the first time, and my mom had a copy of the trilogy and The Hobbit, and my babysitter was talking about, you know, the scene with the barrels going over the waterfall and all of that and detail, and because I asked her what she was reading and I was like, oh, I want to read this book, so I was like, I'm gonna read this book. And she's like, I think this will be a little hard for you. And I was like, I'm going to read this book. Yes, I have a Capricorn rising. So I read Taurus, this book. Capricorn rising. Mm-hmm. What'd you say?
I'm same. Taurus, Capricorn rising.
Same actually. Same. Yeah. So, and of course, like finish it. And my dad's like, wait, you finished that? And I was 9. He's like, I couldn't get through that one. So
we love to interact with people and decide what their interests are, and then that's like, that's always what I tell people who are like, oh, I have a hesitant reader, he's a boy, and I'm like, well, have you asked him what he wants to read, you know? Or, you know,
yeah, when I was at Barnes and Noble as a bookseller, that was like, I ignored the parents and I just asked the kids what they were interested in, and there is no, like you were saying, like each reader their book, like it's not about books being boring or them not being a reader or not being interested. It's just like finding the right one.
Mm-hmm. And then intellectual freedom is an exercise, right? So you know, if you haven't had the freedom to explore your thoughts and interact with other people's thoughts, it can be difficult. Or, you know, if you're in that place with your mental health, you're struggling with focus, a lot of that is, you know, you do the self work, and I think that's part of literacy too. And, you know, you can work yourself up with podcasts, and you can work yourself up with puzzles, and you can work yourself up with pretty much anything that just gets you thinking autonomously. And that's the library is interested in that whole path for you, you know? And you know, we're not just out here making Sally Rooney read-alike lists. You know, there's quite a few of us working on things that really help you get back on your feet, with your, you know, with the freedom of your thoughts. Another thing that people do is vandalism. So we deal with vandalism a lot, where people will just destroy books and hope that we don't replace them. They will sometimes, my favorite is when they check the books out and become financially responsible for them and then destroy them. And then we replace them because we've demonstrated a need that they were checked out and that they need to go back. sometimes with more nicer, newer copies. And then sometimes they get destroyed. And then the way that our budgets work is that we can't replace them all. And that's very disheartening. And then the last way that it's really insidious that it comes in is, I mean, there's a lot of predatory capitalism with publishers and how we're you know, the right of first sale is being challenged as to how
we provide books. Oh my God, don't even get me started. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's better people than me to talk about that, but especially with audiobooks right now, it's becoming increasingly hard, or people who don't have access to the internet, it's becoming increasingly hard to provide them materials that are just not being put in accessible formats for them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But with the board, the way that most public libraries are structured is that you have a board of trustees that are elected by the public on, you know, anywhere between 2, 4, and 6 year terms. And they are the ones who hire the executive director. So you have groups like Moms for Liberty who are setting people up to run for boards of trustees, and then the director's afraid of the board, and then all of a sudden there's limits on who's purchasing what. There's, you know, more restrictive review policies for how books can get, you know, taken off the shelves. And then you just get people who, you know, libraries are been struggling as far as pay goes, as far as full-time staff. Most public libraries aren't unionized. And the only alternative for a union is just full-time professional staff, right? And every librarian you'll talk to is experienced. You know, every time a full-timer retires or leaves, they'll cut the position up into part-time positions. So there's less people to advocate on the basis of professional experience or just a stake in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that just gets harder and harder to you know, that's a way that you just books disappear off the shelves without ever being banned or formally challenged and formally removed.
So what's the state of fighting back against all of this, and what should we be paying attention to now?
There's quite a bit of work being done. Some of the organizations to follow, some of the people who are, you know, involved in lawsuits and you know, amicus briefs and fighting cases of censorship is the Freedom to Read Foundation, which is the intellectual freedom arm of the ALA, the American Library Association. PEN America is also on the job. Digital Public Libraries of America is also invested, but they're also providing, you know, alternatives, which I can talk about. But the Freedom to Read Foundation, PEN America, the ACLU, they're all invested in you know, they have historical backgrounds and fighting challenges. There's a lot of challenges that came up in the 1990s over internet access at libraries. Which is amazing because, you know, after, and I know this is anecdotal, but in 10 years of working in libraries, the obscenity cases that we deal with are mostly older white men who are conspicuously watching pornography whenever the most female presenting staff member is nearby.
Of course.
And it's never kids.
Always. Yes.
Yep. That tracks.
Yes. I confirm that anecdotally as well.
Sorry, I should have put a content warning there, but, you know, that's...
If you know, you know.
Yeah. You know, and that's sort of when the ALA ramped up some of their more, you know, intensive tools and toolkits for librarians to use is during the internet filtering cases in the 90s and the early 2000s. some of the active cases to follow is Pan America has a case against the Escanaba School District that they filed in May of last year after the district removed a large amount of their books from the school and public libraries in 2022 and 2023, mostly books regarding LGBT plus representation and Black history.
Yeah.
One of the more concerning cases that ALA, the ACLU, and Pan America are invested in is the Fayetteville Public Library versus Crawford County. That's against 732, which was the law ratified by Sarah Huckabee Sanders, saying that librarians providing material considered harmful to minors could face up to a penalty of up to a year in jail. That one's very concerning. That one's gained a lot of traction and is I think going to be the standard bearer for
dirty book dealers. Your smutty books. That one's for Jax.
The Reader Act in Texas is another one that is worth watching. That's a lot of people who are making those long, long, long lists of books that need to be removed from libraries.
Which is all of like 11 people, like with too much time on their hands.
Yeah.
It's so obscene to me.
Yeah. And the Lilano County Library versus Lila Green case is another one. There's quite a few bills that are already being, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, just like with anything with these weirdos is you can't cover everything.
We'll put a list in the show notes.
Yeah.
You made us a nice list. We'll put it in the show notes so everybody can go look these up and we'll include these cases as well.
Yeah. I appreciate it there. You know, there's
so much, there's a lot going on.
So many. So like how can people show up? Like, what's the best way for people to support their own local library in, like, providing access and keeping books on the shelves? And, like, are there city council meetings for libraries? What is 100%. The thing?
Can you two
be the Molly Conger of public libraries?
Yeah.
100%. Yeah, we need our socialist dog mom at library board meetings. They do board meetings. At public libraries and you can go to them even if you don't have the time or the energy, even just circulating books that are endangered, you know, books that are important to you that you think that people who are marginalized or in danger of censorship, that really helps. Like I can't tell you, like, as somebody who needs to defend books on a daily basis from public attacks, you know, just having the numbers to back it up to be like, you know, people in this area have demonstrated a need for this material. Here are the numbers. So one of the beautiful things that's somewhat happened that's a little bit similar to the attacks on reproductive rights is that state libraries and city libraries in areas with better autonomy and intellectual freedom have stepped up to provide borderless responses. Mm-hmm. So a couple of them that you can support, that you can look into, that you can recommend to people who are in areas with endangered access is the Digital Public Library of America. Their banned book club basically gives you access to digital materials, ebooks, e-audiobooks, similar to, I think they use the OverDrive platform in some areas and where it's not available, they use either Cloud Library or Quest. Mm-hmm. The Queer Liberation Library, similarly, if you are in an area where your public library doesn't have access, or you are in a situation where, you know, somebody in your life is a danger to you if you are interacting with these materials, you can apply for access through the Queer Liberation Library to have access to Libby and Hoopla so that you can have ebooks and e-audiobooks. And you know, they're not attached to your location. They're not attached to your name or card. You just have access and, you know, nobody needs to know what you're reading.
I love that website has like a banner at the top that's a like quick disappear option.
Yeah.
It'll close it out and take it to the weather app.
They know.
Yeah. And again, it's one of those things where it's just like, accessibility is good for everyone. Mm-hmm. So the same sort of things that, you know, our trans patrons need is the same sort of intellectual freedom and privacy and freedom from censorship that our homeschool kids need.
Mm-hmm.
the Brooklyn Public Library's books unbanned, basically. If they if a book has been challenged, they add it to open access through their library. So,
nice.
it's less of a catalog, and the same thing through Chicago Public Library's book sanctuary. So you can go to booksanctuary.org. Brooklyn Public Library, Chicago Public Library, and Las Vegas Clark District Libraries do that, where if a book has been banned, they basically say, okay, we're going to open access outside of our borders to our e-resources for these books.
Amazing.
Chicago Public Library, through the Book Sanctuary, actually, you can actually sign up to be a book shelter. So you can sign up to collect banned books and distribute them based on requests and based on need.
Cool.
You can, that's a really good way to support. And then, yeah, call your congresspeople. I know that's overwhelm them. Call your congresspeople who are either introducing these bills or sitting on these bills, and go use your public library card, even if you don't feel like you have to, because, part of providing community includes people who are invested in other people, whether or not we're all stakeholders. We're all the public library. Like I love to tell people that, the library can't hold all of its materials at one given time. Like we require them, like we bank on a certain amount of materials being out in your homes at any given time. When the pandemic first started, everybody tried to return everything all at once. And like, we just got, there was like books all over the floor. And the library is requiring you, the library needs things to be in flux. We need you to be interacting with them. We need you to be, using our materials, and that's part of the mission is that we're all little branches of the library and little bastions of intellectual freedom for the kids
and
adults in our lives.
We are all the library.
Yeah. I remember hearing that before, and I'm glad you brought it up again. That's so beautiful. I have a question that's telling on myself a little bit, and then we can probably wrap it up. So one, my understanding of it's good to keep books, checked out in circulation, even if you're not like using them, right? So does it count if I'm putting books on reserve and my ADHD means that I forget to pick them up?
It depends on your system.
I'm constantly like, reserving more than I need, and then I'll like get like half of them because I forgot to pick up the rest of them.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So like most libraries that I've worked with and interacted with will count that as not a checkout, but as an interaction, and it gets reported as such, and it gets tied to that book. So like the last time it was circulated was the last time it was put on hold and then not checked out. But yeah, you can totally do that. Or with same thing with e-resources, if you check them out and don't read them.
Okay.
Yeah,
that the e-resources feels a little more obvious, but I also don't want to be wasting people's labor.
Nah, you're good.
Well, thank you for all the work that you do and all the information you share here and elsewhere, and for making yourself available to talk to us about this so important, and really happy that you're out there doing this work.
Happy to be here.
People want to find out more about your work or about your pies. Where can they do that?
Can I plug other librarians first?
Yes, you totally can. Please plug all the librarians.
Better people from me than me that I've learned so much from. My mentor in school is the chairperson for the Freedom to Read Foundation, and her name is Emily Knox. She recently testified in front of Congress, and just watching her answer Lindsey Graham's questions was such a wild experience for me. And you can find her on Emily Knox, EmilyKnox.net, and her writing about censorship and intellectual freedom and access and the importance of public libraries and the public sphere is super valuable. Another librarian that's just doing great advocacy work is Fobazi Etar. You can find her on Twitter at Fobettarh. And she is doing great work both for libraries and within libraries. So she's doing a lot of the work to kind of decolonize some of these ideas that we have about libraries and the historical structure and who deserves to be considered a patron and who deserves to be considered a librarian. Mm-hmm. So she's wonderful. And then, another intellectual freedom hero of mine is Cory Doctorow.
Yes. Love him.
I asked I graduated during the pandemic, my MLIS. I'd been a library employee for 10 years, but I was a paraprofessional for about six. And when I was hitting librarianship at the beginning of a pandemic, I was like, okay, not only am I graduating and we're not getting a graduation, we're not getting a commencement. So I reached out to like 10 different people, and he was the first person to respond and gave the best response. And I just asked him, like, what are we going to do? And he told us that, you know, crisis is a crossroads, and we have this opportunity to decide, you know, what kind of institution we want to be going forward. And librarianship is about the fundamental dignity of each person. And we have the ability to protect and preserve and grow this public space for the people that other people have considered superfluous to our needs. And it's just such a beautiful perspective. I included that video that he sent me in the document for y'all.
We'll have that in the notes too. He's so good. I love him.
Those three people. But yeah, if you really want my garbage takes and my less garbage pies, I'm at Eddie Criston on most platforms, or Eddie the Giant Librarian. I'm a very large person. That's not a flex on how good of a librarian I am. It's just a physical fact.
Amazing. This was wonderful. Thank you so much. I've learned so much about libraries just in talking to you and watching your stuff. And like from Berlin, yeah, you bring me a lot of hope for the future of libraries. So I'm cheering you on from across the ocean.
Thank you. Thank you both. And thank you for this, just all the work you've done with the Coalition for Responsible Homeschooling. It's been great to follow you for so long and feel less alone in my building back up of my human self.
Solidarity.
So bad. And thank you, everyone, for listening. This month is going to be really great. We are focusing a lot on libraries. So if you have any questions that come up, like, let us know. Send us an email. Shoot us a message on Slack or comment in Patreon, whatever it is that you do. Rate this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and we will see you soon.
Bye.
Bye. You've been listening to the Kitchen Table Cult podcast. Our music is from the track Janet by the band The Heavens on their album Stenazzo. Our producer is Dave the Great. Our podcast is made possible by Patreon donations from listeners like you. To support us and join our community on Slack, check out patreon.com/kitchentablecultpod. Thanks for listening.